Thank you for listening to the Mormon Book Review podcast, hosted by Kirk Cottle. The Mormon Book Review features authors of books dealing with all aspects of Mormonism. This podcast is entirely user-supported, so if you like this podcast, please consider donating to our site by clicking on the Donate tab located on the right side of the page. An archive of all of our shows and links to the books of authors interviewed can be found at www.themormonbookreview.com.
Hello, everybody out there in podcast land. This is Kirk Cottle, and welcome back again to the Mormon Book Review. We appreciate you always as listening. The book we will be speaking about today is called Shaken Faith Syndrome, which is actually the second edition, which is expanded and revised now, Strengthening One's Testimony in the Face of Criticism and Doubt, authored by Michael R. Ash. Michael R. Ash is a veteran staff member of the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research, commonly known as FAIR, former weekly columnist for the Mormon Times, and has presented several papers at LDS-related symposiums. Ash is the author of the book, again, we'll be talking about today, Shaken Faith Syndrome, Strengthening One's Testimony in the Face of Criticism and Doubt, as well as Of Faith and Reason, 80 Evidences Supporting the Prophet Joseph Smith. Ash writes a semi-monthly column for Meridian Magazine's online publication and has written more than 100 articles defending the faith. Ash has had articles published by FAIR, Farms, Sunstone, Dialogue, and most recently in The Ensign. Michael, welcome to the Mormon Book Review.
Thanks, Kirk. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Yeah, no problem. It's great to have you here. And as I look at your book right in front of me, the first chapter is entitled Dealing with Doubt. What is your personal relationship with religious doubt?
I think that probably anybody that really thinks about their religion in their lifetimes, if they're committed and they have any kind of curiosity, will face episodes of doubt. I'm probably no different than anybody else. There have been times in my life where I've doubted not only maybe religion in general or the existence of God, or but in Mormonism as well. And you know, it's either because of tough times that I was going through, and you wonder, is, you know, God listening, or is he really out there, or how can this happen to me? And in my younger years, in my 20s, I had a period where I struggled with doubt and belief of the LDS faith because of things that I had read that were critical of the church. And so I've experienced some of the same types of things that people that I'm addressing the book to have gone through. And I came out of those difficulties with a stronger faith because I explored answers to those questions. And, you know, that's what I've tried to do in my book as well, is provide answers and resources for other people that might be struggling or have family members that are struggling.
Was there a particular issue that you really struggled with out of all of them?
When the Mark Hoffman forgeries were going on with the Salamander letter, that was actually a big one that kind of startled me. I also had read a couple of anti-Mormon books and gone to see The Godmakers, which was back in the early 80s, an anti-Mormon movie. I saw it at a local church, and there were several issues thrown out to me at that time that were pretty startling. Things about the Book of Abraham, about Book of Mormon anachronisms, you know, things, archaeology in the Book of Mormon. So there was a whole slew of things, but one of the things that probably hit the hardest that I recall was the Salamander letter. At least at the time, it just sounded so strange compared to what I had learned in the church. And of course, we know now that it was a forgery, but at that time, people didn't know it. And so, yeah, it was definitely faith shaking. And there's been little things, you know, that happened through the years or around the same time that caused some definite doubts to creep into my testimony, but that's the one that sticks out most in my mind.
How did those around you deal with that? Were you open with it with parents or siblings or friends, or was it something that you kept inside?
I asked my dad is not a scholar, but he's an intelligent person, and I went to him with some of the questions that I had read about, at least anti-Mormon charges, and he had some answers. I didn't have all the answers, but he had a strong testimony and was able to point out that there was things that were incorrect, some of the anti-Mormon claims. I don't think that I came across as like I was about to fall away from the church, from my doubts, at least not to my parents. But my dad could definitely see that I had some concerns about what I was reading. There was, this happened when I was in Colorado Springs, and interestingly enough, it really didn't seem that most of the members in my ward or in my circle of friends, this is all pre-internet days, that any of them really had much of a clue of some of these arguments that were going on. And so there really wasn't anybody else to turn to at that time other than my dad. As I began exploring more, I discovered farms. And that's really what kind of, I guess, solidified my testimony, because Farms was founded in 1979. And this was taking place in approximately, you know, maybe 82 to 84. And so Farms was still a fairly young organization, but they had a number of papers that they had written, and one of which was responding to the Salamander letter. And again, it's forgery, and so none of that holds water anymore. But that kind of opened the door for me to realize that, hey, there is research out there that answers, you know, many of these questions. And there's also research out there that supports belief in Mormonism. And so it was kind of my own explorations of reading that strengthened my testimony.
One thing I think that's interesting that you said is your dad's not a scholar, and he's somebody you went to. And I think many of us have experiences like that. And so what role do you think scholars and non-scholars play when people are doubting testimonies? Because truth be told, right, the vast majority of people in the church are not scholars, but yet they help people all the time.
Right. I guess it depends on the level of testimony damage that's going on. There are, FAIR is made up of scholars and non-scholars, and there are, you know, I don't consider myself a scholar. I think I'm educated on the issues. I'm kind of a student of the scholars, and really that's kind of what I've tried to do in all my writings, is take the writings that scholars have already produced and work those into a way that hopefully addresses the layman audience. For somebody that's struggling, sometimes bishops are able to help, sometimes home teachers or the family members are able to help, but sometimes if you don't have anybody to turn to that really has a satisfying answer to some of the difficult questions, that can kind of build up inside of you. And if there aren't answers that are forthcoming, then there's a risk of the testimony collapsing. And that's not for all people. It's very interesting. In my studies, I found that some people, they can hear these things and just push them aside or put them on a shelf and think, well, I don't really have to worry about that. I have my spiritual witness, and that's all I need. And someday there'll be answers for these other questions. Other people, however, they also have strong testimonies, but they tend to maybe dwell on some of these difficulties and say, man, if there's not an answer for this that fits with belief, then how can the church be true? So it's probably as different per individual as it can be.
And so with all this, you believe doubt is healthy?
Yeah, I think we have to have some doubt in our lives. It's like anything else. In fact, I many times equate my book to inoculation as well. In fact, I mentioned even shaken faith syndrome, because my book's not only written to help people that are struggling with testimonies, but it's to help people maybe to inoculate members who haven't even come across these issues before. And so they already have kind of this antibodies built up in their system to fight the difficulties that might come later. Well, I think that's the kind of how doubt works as well. You know, doubt is good for us, because if we didn't question things, it's really hard to go forward in life. You know, Joseph Smith doubted what he was hearing at the times. That's what led him to the Grove of Trees. He doubted some of the things that, because of what Emma had told him about, you know, the smoke-filled rooms, the School of Prophets, things like that, he began to question those things, which led to the Word of Wisdom. So doubt many times leads to revelation, whether personal or on a prophetic level. It comes most often through questions. So we need doubt in our lives because it gives us strength. But on the flip side, again, like in inoculation, some people die when they get shots of inoculation. So it can damage testimonies. It's a double-edged sword, and that's why we have to be careful, and it's best to know that, yeah, there are difficult issues out there, but there are also answers out there.
Now, kind of on another note here, I'm holding your book in my hand, and on page 15, you throw out a few very disturbing stats, or at least they are in my mind, regarding books. So let me go through them very quickly. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them. 1/3 of high school graduates never read another book for the rest of their lives. 58% of the U.S. adult population never reads another book after high school. 42% of college graduates never read another book. 80% of U.S. families did not buy or read a book last year. 70% of U.S. adults have not been in a bookstore in the last 5 years. 57% of new books are not read to completion. Now, of course, somebody like me who hosts a show called The Mormon Book Review has a big love for books, so of course I'm probably a little bit biased on this point, but how do stats like these affect us from a religious standpoint?
They're detrimental to us in many ways, not just from a religious standpoint, but just being aware of the world around us. You know, I list some stats in here as well, how people don't know that the Earth goes around the sun, that it takes 365 days to do it. I mean, there's just all types of things that, unfortunately, the average person lacks in education. And that sets us up for stumbling blocks, because when we are confronted with information that runs contrary to what we had believed, again, we probably don't know, or people don't know that there's answers out there because they haven't done enough reading, or they might be exposed to something for the first time. For instance, you know, I'm surprised to find that a number of Latter-day Saints don't know that Joseph Smith practiced plural marriage. And, you know, if you would ask me that many years ago, I would have said, no, I mean, that's a common belief among Latter-day Saints. But I do find that there are a number of faithful Latter-day Saints have been members of the lives who don't know that. And it's generally because just of a lack of reading, that they don't take the time to even read church books or official church publications. And of course, what that leads to is that when they're confronted with this information from a critical source, then it's like, holy smokes, the church has been hiding this information. Well, no, it's not hidden necessarily. It's just that most people haven't looked for it because they haven't tried to educate themselves. So yeah, education is one of the most powerful tools to strengthening our testimony. We should not be afraid of it, whether it's education, it's science, religion, history, whatever. Truth is truth, and it's all part of God's truth, and we can understand our religion better, as well as ourselves and our world around us better, with greater education.
You bring up the Joseph Smith and polygamy issue, and I've said this on at least one other show, but I never even heard about the Joseph Smith practicing polygamy until early adulthood. And so interesting you bring that up. And what, just a couple episodes ago, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I talked to Brian Hale. So if you want to know more about that issue, you can go back and listen to that episode. But my larger question surrounding this is, where should we be hearing about these issues? It's like something like Joseph Smith and polygamy. Is it something that we should learn from a church manual? Or do you really think it's up to the individual to just run into these in a book? And I'm not talking about an anti-Mormon book, but just a church history book or something.
Maybe a little of both. I would be happy to see a little more history injected into some of the church manuals. And I think the church is aware of this, and they're trying to do more. The Joseph Smith papers are online now, so people can read the stuff for themselves. With the internet and digital scanning, a lot more of this information is becoming available. And I think that the church has recognized, too, that there's people that have really fallen behind. However, on the opposite side, when we go to church, whether it's to Sunday school, to Priesthood Relief Society, a sacrament meeting, we're not there to learn history. We're there to be edified, spiritually edified. And so the curriculum is focused on helping us draw closer to God and applying those principles in our everyday lives. Well, when we leave church on Sunday, what have we learned that's going to make us better people throughout the week to help motivate us and to strengthen us and to carry us through until we renew our covenants with the sacrament the following week. And so that's really what the focus is. And so even when we go through the Doctrine and Covenants, which is kind of a church history thing, it's focused on those principles. And so it's difficult to inject a lot of history in there. And like I said, I think the church is aware of it, and we may see some changes coming. But I should point out that Joseph Smith being plurally married has been mentioned in the church curriculum tools, in the manuals, in the Ensign. I list some of these sources in my book, so it's not like it's been hidden. It's just not brought up very frequently. And so I guess if for those people that, you know, might miss that Sunday, or maybe the teacher doesn't bring it up, even though it's in the manual, then maybe they don't hear about it. But it's been there, just probably needs to be there a little bit more. But as Latter-day Saints, where we understand the glory of God as intelligence, we should, I think, be making the efforts to study these things in ourselves so we just don't bump into them and are shaken by them.
In this book, you go through a variety of arguments against the truth claims of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And for anyone listening, if you really want to look at a book that has a bunch of arguments and defense of those arguments for the church, this is definitely a book for you. You go through most of them pretty briefly, but that's understandable. I mean, or else the book's going to be 5,000 pages long. But I think it's really good at least to dip your toe into the water, proverbially, of a lot of these issues. And so of these, which, if any, and this kind of piggybacks on a question that I asked you at the beginning of the podcast too, did you have the hardest time dealing with while actually writing the book? And on the other side of things, what did you have the easiest time dealing with? What issues do you think are real straw men?
This has to be obviously based on a personal perspective, because some people will find certain issues more difficult than other people. I think probably starting with the easiest, one argument that I see pulled up frequently by critics is still the DNA argument. And to me, that's one of the most easily refuted arguments, because I added actually quite a bit more material into the second edition than the first edition on the DNA issue. And if we accept the premise that the Lehites were a small incursion into a larger populace of existing Native Americans here, it is extremely likely that their DNA would have been swamped out and disappeared. So the DNA science, if we look at it strictly from a scientific point of view, there is no argument against the Book of Mormon from DNA. It must revert back to the critics saying, well, according to earlier leaders in the church, the Lehites were the sole inhabitants of the New World, and so they're the ones that populated everything, and so that's why the DNA should be there. Well, that's no longer a scientific argument. That's more of a debate of interpretation of the scripture. There have been leaders since practically Joseph Smith's day that have suggested that the Lehites weren't alone in here. So it's not like all of a sudden this is a new defense based on DNA. This has been going on for a while. So the DNA issue to me, I think, is one of the weakest. And there's other ones that I think are pretty weak in here as well. Probably the most difficult, maybe two, and again, I don't find these very difficult, but ones I can see that are difficult for a number of people is plural marriage, regardless of whether it's Joseph Smith or just Latter-day Saints in general, especially from a Christian Western 21st century society that we live in. Anything that has to do with plural intimacy, you know, that sends up a bunch of red flags right away. I mean, we see stuff in the news. You have people that claim either to be prophets or just perverts that are looking for younger girls, or, you know, kidnappings or taking other wives and stuff like that. Jeffs and all these people that end up in the news. And it's easy to translate these in hindsight back to Joseph Smith and think that he was a lech and was no better than these men. But again, I try to deal with this in the plural marriage chapter and point out that we can't understand from there, and that the women that were involved in this, especially the ones I deal with Joseph Smith there, Joseph Smith asked them to seek their own testimonies on it, not to just take his word for it, to pray about it. And there's some very powerful, moving testimonies about some of these women that understood from God that this was the thing that God's asked them to do. It's difficult for us to understand, nevertheless. And so I think that presents a hurdle for a number of people. The other one is, I think, the Book of Abraham. and mostly because there's a lot of unknowns still going on with this. It's kind of a wide open field, and there's several theories that I lay out in the book that all are consistent with belief, but we really don't have a complete handle on all the details to say this is the silver bullet that kills this argument. We know that the existing papyri, what we have that the church owns, does not translate as the Book of Abraham. However, that doesn't mean that the Book of Abraham that we have didn't come divinely inspired to Joseph Smith, or that it wasn't necessarily on the papyri that Joseph Smith owned back early 1800s, because some of that papyri is missing. So there's a lot of debate about that, and hopefully in time, and the Kirtland Egyptian papers that tie to it, it looks like Joseph Smith was trying to translate from these characters, and they really don't translate to Egyptian. You know, what's going on there? And there really are no good answers, 100%, definitive answers on either side, whether it's critics or believers, and so it's a little bit wide open. But I think there's enough information for a believer to lean on to that can say, okay, this answers this problem, and that shouldn't be a stumbling block to my testimony, especially since there's so many other things, you know, virtually all the other criticisms, my belief, are shot down, and there's a lot of supporting evidences from a scientific standpoint that strengthen belief as well. And so if you have an anomaly here or there that maybe we don't have a full answer to, you know, maybe those are one of the things that we can put on a shelf and work on slowly. And I believe that more answers are forthcoming.
If there's someone out there that's listening to this podcast and they're questioning the church for these intellectual reasons that we're talking about and whether or not the church is true, what would you tell that person?
Well, the most important thing to understand is that, first of all, we cannot know strictly from an intellectual standpoint that the church is true. It's not going to be possible. We cannot know that there is a God from a completely intellectual standpoint, or that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. We just cannot know these things. At some point, we have to rely on faith. We have to, you know, turn our hearts over to the Lord and pray, even if there's that little, that mustard seed, that seed, actually that talks about now, that we want that to grow. We have that desire to want to know the truth, and we put forth the spiritual effort, we can receive the answer. However, the intellectual arguments or strength can factor into our openness to receive this revelation. So if the intellectual arguments seem too massive, it can harden our hearts. And so we make up our minds before we even pray and say, I don't see any way this can be true. And so it's not. So it's kind of no use to pray, or we really don't pray with a real intent. However, finding that there are answers to the intellectual criticisms and that the church is on strong ground, that doesn't prove the church is true, but I think it softens the heart and allows God to speak to us.
And of course, none of us in the church want anybody to leave the church. I don't know that any of us celebrate when somebody leaves, but all of us know somebody who has and are still good people, at least in my experience. So do you believe that there is ever a legitimate reason for an individual to leave the church?
Sure. I think that it's legitimate if they, it's a completely personal journey. In the end, it doesn't come down to President Monson, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, anybody. It comes down to us and Heavenly Father. It's a one-on-one personal experience. And if we cannot accept that, if we are not, you know, do not find that in our spiritual quest, if we've done everything that we can spiritually and intellectually and still cannot make that connection, you know, why would somebody stay? And so, you know, I don't have a problem with people that say, I left the church, I struggle, I don't have a testimony. That's their own personal choice. They have to work that out. And I also do believe that God, He knows all the factors that are involved. And for some people, it may seem overwhelming and they may leave the church, but He doesn't give up on them. That we have the story of the prodigal son, and not saying that, you know, that people that leave are sinful or anything like that, but we have stories of people that leave and come back, and the Lord's not going to give up on them. We shouldn't either. And so if they want to separate themselves from the church, that has to be their choice, and we have to respect that.
And as we wrap up the interview today, I want to ask you the questions that I ask all of my guests on the show. Number one, what does the future hold for Michael Ash? And number two, do you have anything else that you would like to add to our conversation today that we either couldn't get to about doubt, or is there just anything in general that you'd like to plug and tell us about?
Sure, thank you. As far as the future goes, I recently started writing for Meridian Magazine, a semi-monthly column. It's at ldsmag.com. And include some of the stuff that's in Shaky Face Syndrome, but also some new material, new ideas, and kind of things that I'm thinking about that tie into spiritual damage. I also am working on a book that might be out quite a ways in the future where I try to reconcile more of the scientific problems that maybe atheists face with LDS belief. So that's something that's somewhere out on the horizon. As far as a plug, I'm a member of FAIR, who published this book, the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research, and we are holding our annual conference in Provo on August 1st and August 2nd. If you go to fairlds.org, you can see where the conference is being held, the times and the dates, and there's actually early sign up right now where there's a discount on it, and it's always a wonderful conference. We bring in some awesome speakers, so anybody that's interested in LDS studies should definitely attend this.
And what are the dates of that again?
August 1st and August 2nd. It's a Thursday and Friday, the first Thursday and Friday in August in Provo.
All right, excellent. My guest today has been Michael R. Ash. The book is Shaken Face Syndrome, Strengthening One's Testimony in the Face of Criticism and Doubt. And this is the second edition, which is now expanded and revised. And as Michael just said a few moments ago, it is published by FAIR, the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research. And if you'd like to get a copy of this book, as always, just go ahead and click the link that you'll find on the website, probably where you found this podcast. Michael, thank you very much for joining me today on the Mormon Book Review.
Thanks for having me, Kirk.
Thank you for listening. Please visit us again at www.themormonbookreview.com.